Hi, I'm Otto. Welcome to Erin Sarah's podcast.
I have to tell you, I was a little starstruck meeting this guest. No, he's iconic here. People, you say Rabbi Stephen Leader, and people just like,
he's like a rock star.
He's very beloved, and I am not Jewish, but there were so many takeaways for me.
Listen, for Rabbi Leader, when I met Rabbi Leader, when I went to one of his sermons, when I was deciding if I wanted to convert to be Jewish, when I watched him speak, it really transformed for me the way I saw religion. Because the way he spoke didn't feel religious. It was like one person talking to another about life. And that's what made me feel like I wanted to be Jewish.
And that's what this episode is not a religious episode at all. This episode really just ended up being a conversation about so much more than even his book that he wrote, which we do get into his book. And his book is just such a beautiful read. And I can't.
But you know what? Let's wrap this up. Right. People listen to the episode because you love to talk about the episode that people are about to listen to.
I do, but I just want people to know that we talked about the meaning of life. We talked about relationships. We talked about how it's okay not to have it all. We talked about...
Realize that in a minute when they hear it.
Yes, but I just want to prepare our audience, Erin. Some people might be like, oh, a rabbi. I don't know if that really resonates with me. I'm not Jewish or I'm not religious or that's all I'm trying to do. I'm trying to say this was truly a conversation about being a good human being, about being a human being who feels
you're
at
saying,
peace.
Don't hit the pause button. Hit the play button.
Hit the play button is what I'm saying.
Hit the play button, everyone.
This was one of my favorite conversations, I have to say, out of all of our episodes.
Well, you're welcome to come convert with me.
I just said it. All right. Here is the legend, Rabbi Stephen Leader.
Beginning the conversation with Rabbi Leader, who we are very excited to have here. He is the, well, I don't know, would you call it like the main rabbi at Rabbi? How do you say it?
The senior rabbi.
Okay. I think of him as the main rabbi. the senior rabbi at Wilshire Boulevard Temple. That is the temple where I converted to Judaism. You can add in some applause later in the audio.
Our best brand ambassador.
Yeah. I really am. I pushed like the Jewish conversion very hard.
I got to be honest. Like
Jews are very welcoming. They took me in. They were like, blonde, we'll take her.
Good for the gene pool.
Yeah. I had a meeting with Rabbi Leader before Simon. I honestly think it may have been before Simon and I were engaged. I don't remember.
I think it was.
Because Simon was like, you know why it was? It's because he was clearly, you know, being the controlling person he was, said I have to convert to Judaism or else he won't marry me. And so then I said, well, before we get engaged, like, let me just test it out and see how I feel about it before I commit to something. He basically didn't want to propose unless I knew it was something I wanted to do. So we had this meeting and I was telling Rabbi Leader how, you know, how much of a like unconventional background I came from and how resistant I was to the idea of religion and all this stuff. And then I said, well, anyway, this conversation's, you know, pointless until Simon proposes anyway, which I'll let you know when that happens. And he goes, are you sure you're not Jewish? Or he goes, you sound like a Jewish girl if I've ever met one. It was really funny. It was very funny. So my first question to you.
Whoa, you're just getting right into questions?
Well, it's not like a grilling. It's like something, it's a conversation.
But it's also, I think it's important. I am.
Oh, I didn't know you were going to talk too.
Well, I am not. Can I say I'm not a Jew?
Yes.
Well, yes, you can. But this is a question. Like, can you say Jew when you're not a Jew? We'll get to it.
Well, let's get to it right now. Can I say I am not a Jew?
Of course. Really? If you're not a Jew, you can say you're not a Jew.
But you, okay. You don't need to say, well, because Simon has a different...
Simon's sensitive to the word Jew.
He's very sensitive to it.
He's actually the person who told me I'm not allowed to say it because I...
He refers to it as the hard J.
Well, I think that, no, yeah.
That is something that American Jews got over two generations ago.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a remnant in every immigrant population.
Yeah.
Because it's also partly that it doesn't sound American. So for example, that's why synagogues like Wilshire Boulevard Temple is called a temple, because it sounded more American. It sounded less ethnic. That's why, for example, The organization that the Reform movement, the more liberal movement in Judaism in America, used to be called the Union of American Hebrew Congregations. They shied away from the word Jew because it was too ethnic. It was too pointed, you know. But then what happened was, thank goodness, the 1960s came along and we had Black Power and feminism and we had people owning their identity in new ways. And of course, we had enough distance from our immigrant past and the Holocaust mm-hmm. to feel more secure in America. Mm-hmm. And of course, the birth of Israel in 1948, which changed the world's image of Jew from victim to assertive and capable. Mm-hmm. And pioneer-like. And so you began to have a much more affirmative understanding of the word and much greater comfort with the word. But Simon's coming from a different reality, as you know, which is the old Soviet Russian system, which oppressed Jews, and where that word could literally land you in jail for years.
Yeah. Yeah. So for people who don't know, Simon is Russian. His parents are Russian immigrants. They fled Moscow to come to America because they were Jewish, and they had to put their dental practice in the basement, because if anyone found out that Jews were had their own dental practice, they would be put in prison, I think. So yeah, they so always...
You can understand the sensitivity. The best we can hope for, and I'm pretty sure this is true, Aaron, knowing you as well as I do, that your children are going to be very proud of that word and their identity, right, without a doubt.
I agree. Well, when I was in my conversion class, which Rabbi Leder didn't run the conversion class, Rabbi Shapiro did, but Rabbi Leder came in and obviously, you know, participated a lot. I asked the question to him and to the class, like, is Jew offensive? Because Simon and I have sort of had disagreements over that. Obviously, I don't have a right to have an opinion on it because I wasn't Jewish, but I grew up around American Jews who weren't sensitive, like you said, about the word. So I was very accustomed to like having a lightness around the word because I didn't say it with hatred, obviously. And he said, I think it's fine. It's the intent that you use it with.
Of course, of course. The language always is a reflection of the larger ethos of the subculture, right? And that changes. That changes.
Well, so, right. So I was going to say, I'm not a Jew or I am not a Jewish person, but since Rabbi Leder has given me his blessing, I'm not a Jew, but I don't go to synagogue, to your temple, but I hear about you all the time. People talk about you as just a wise man. You're a husband, you're a father, you're a spiritual leader, you're a teacher, you're a scholar, you're all those things, but you're very beloved in this community. Mm-hmm. And we're just like, we're really honored to have you here.
Wow. Thank you for saying that. And, you know, this community and its place in Los Angeles has been my obsession for 33 years. Being a rabbi at Wilshire Boulevard Temple is the only job I've ever had as an adult. Wow. They hired me when I was 26 years old and I've never left.
It's amazing.
So I do care about it and this little village that we're growing. And obviously we can't please everyone all the time, but I have worked hard to take good care of people. And mm-hmm. I think that's the best any of us can do.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny. My daughter, she's 9 and she's never grown up with religion. You know, we celebrate Christmas, all the things. We focus on the golden rule, you know, but we don't really instill a religion in them. And her thing is always like, it's not fair that we're not Jewish. Why are we not Jewish? It's not fair. You know, what she associates it with really is family, because she goes to her friends' houses and they have Friday Shabbat and there's so many holy holidays and it's the food and it's the coming together. She doesn't know. She's just turned 10, but she's been really saying this since she was 8. And that is what
I like to think we were part of that as well.
Well, no, of course. And you, but most of her friends are Jewish. And she just doesn't understand that you know, you're either born Jewish, it's a bloodline, or you have to work hard to convert. She just goes like, it's not fair. I want to be Jewish, because she associates it with really love and community and family.
Well, that's great.
Beautiful. And very often,
yeah,
when someone comes to talk to me about converting to Judaism in their 20s or 30s, they sit down and say, most of my friends have been Jewish. I've always loved Shabbat at my friend's home.
Yeah.
I loved going to bar bat mitzvahs. Yeah. I've always felt comfortable around Jews, and I want to become a Jew. So, you know, that might be your daughter someday.
Totally. The thing that came up for me when I saw that you wrote this book called The Beauty of What Remains, right? Yeah. That's what I'm saying, right? Because the book is about death. And so in my short experience, well, you know, I mean, that's generalizing.
Yes.
Is that in my short experience being Jewish and being around a lot of Jews, very superstitious. Now, if you're around a Russian Jew, it's like double superstition, but Jews Correct. In general are very superstitious. And joking about death or talking about death or talking about illness, or like Simon always gets upset when I'm talking about some ailment someone has and I point to myself when I talk about it, like, oh, it's right here on the throat. He has throat cancer. He's like, don't point on yourself. So the superstition is very high. I've always been told by Jews, you're really not allowed to talk about death or joke about death. And so I'm very curious to understand how this came about, because it feels like such an off limits topic.
Well, it's really not. It's not a taboo subject in Judaism at all. We, for example, say the mourner's prayer 3 times a day, every day in our services. We have, you know, 4 services a year called Yizkor, remembrance, when we remember our loved ones who have died. So it's layered in to, death is layered into the life of Judaism. And the holiest night of the Jewish year, the eve of Yom Kippur, called Kol Nidre, is actually the Jewish Day of the Dead. It is an evening and day that follows. It's a 24-hour period constructed to force, it mimics death. It forces us to think about our deaths so that we change our lives. I'll give you some examples. The whole service begins, everyone traditionally is dressed in white because Jews are buried in a white linen burial shroud. We fast because the dead neither eat nor drink. The service begins by removing the 3 Torah scrolls from the ark where they're contained, and they're held by 3 people while this prayer about our vows is chanted. Now, those 3 Torah scrolls and those 3 people represent metaphorically the 3 judges in the heavenly tribunal before whom we will have to stand to make an accounting of ourselves after we die. This is obviously myth and legend. Mm-hmm. Now, here's the one that's really gripping, in my opinion. That place where those scrolls are taken out of, where they're held, is called an aron in Hebrew, or ark in English. And that is the same word that's used for casket. Mm. So there you are, standing before the heavenly tribunal, staring into an empty casket, metaphorically. Mm-hmm. So the whole day is structured to force us to consider our deaths. Why? So that we lead more meaningful lives. Yeah. You know, you said, Aaron, that I wrote this book about death. And people have said to me, how did you spend 2 years writing a book about death? And I say, I didn't. I spent 2 years writing a book about what death, how death teaches us to lead more meaningful and more beautiful lives. Mm-hmm. Because death is the only teacher, the mm-hmm. only teacher. Imagine if we lived deathless lives.
We'd be the Imagine most reckless that. People ever.
We would have no ambition. No one would get married. No one would have children. No one would care about improving or changing anything at all. Think for a moment about, I'm going to paraphrase the poet Wallace Stevens. He didn't say it exactly like this, but basically he said, the beauty of a flower is that it fades. That's why nobody is moved by plastic flowers. Nobody cares about plastic flowers. You know why? Because they have no death.
That's so they true. No
Interesting.
It really is so
They
true.
Have no life because they have no death. So it really is finitude. The fact that our lives are finite is the great teacher, is what gives them meaning. And that's why I called the book The Beauty of What Remains. Mm-hmm. It makes what remains beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Right. A book that is essentially about death, but that teaches us and inspires us how to live. Right? Exactly. So death is sort of right. the But
exactly. That's why the subtitle is how our greatest fear becomes our greatest gift.
Mm-hmm. Right. And we all, you know, you say, I want us all to lead more meaningful, more beautiful lives, less anxious and less frantic. Hello. Like, I think about this all day. How do I would like to live that life?
Sarah's a very frantic person.
I read, I do therapy. I do these things. I mean, I don't have a rabbi in my life, which I'm starting to think.
Well, I was thinking you might convert after this podcast.
I mean, I know the prayer. I can say it.
Plenty of room on the bus, Sarah. Plenty of room.
Yeah,
on
the Sarah, give us the prayer.
Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Halom Asher Kiddushanu B'Mitzvotav Avitzivanu L'Had Likner Shel Hanukkah?
Or Shabbat, right?
Or Shabbat.
Or Hanukkah, yeah.
I'm on my way. I'm on my way.
You're rounding first. Good job.
Yeah, very good.
But I mean, like, listen, I want to live my life like that. Like, I think that we're all, especially now in this day of, at least in my bubble, we're all so on the hustle, right? We have children. Yeah. We have multiple jobs. No one's just that one profession anymore, right? Like, my pediatrician has a TV show who also, we're all sort of, we have very frantic lives.
We do, because we have been sold a lie. Mm-hmm. We've been sold a lie, sometimes by our parents when we were very young, but definitely by popular culture.
Yeah.
And by capitalism to a degree, that a busy life is a meaningful life. And the fact is, if the pandemic, there are many things, you know, I obviously didn't start this book knowing it would land in the middle of the worst pandemic in a century, when everybody would be thinking about loss and death. And there are many types of deaths. We've all lost so much. First of all, we've all lost our sense of invulnerability, which is very frightening. And we've lost the most important of human pleasures, which is to hold and be held by the people we love. You know, I have an 87-year-old mom in Minneapolis. I haven't hugged my mother in a year. And we've lost jobs, money. We've lost the right for our children to be in school, which is where they belong.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you.
You know, so this book lands when we're all struggling with loss. And one of the things I hope the pandemic has come to teach us, and that we don't revert to our default settings, is that a busy life and a meaningful life are not necessarily the same thing. They are not the same thing.
So true.
It's so true.
But it makes us feel meaningful somehow.
Well, in the interim, right? Like, in the interim, the highs are so high, and you think like I'm killing it in work. I've never killed it in work the way I have. But guess what? My kids don't think I'm killing it as a mom. I don't see them. I mean,
I'll tell you something. I gave a sermon many years ago that really, I'm just going to be straight up with the two of you, that really upset a lot of women.
Okay.
You can't have it all.
I got up there and said,
I agree.
Sorry, there's a plane, and I just don't want you to say anything meaningful while the plane's happening.
Okay. But while the plane is here, I have to tell you, I don't believe you cannot be 100% as a wife, a mother, your career, a friend.
Okay.
It's fucking impossible.
Yeah. Right. So what I said was, you cannot be great at more than one thing.
Yeah.
You can be, I said, my goal is to be a good rabbi and a great husband and father.
Oh, love him.
Right? Because good has to be good enough sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And we all have to make choices. And of course, someone then pushed back. This really upset a lot of women of my generation who were raised to believe the opposite. You absolutely can have it all. And if you don't, there's something wrong with you.
Well, listen, it's a reaction, because women were told they couldn't, they could, women were always told we could only have one thing.
Right.
And we don't want to only have one thing. We want to have at least three things. And so I think it's hard to hear,
but can't be great at three things.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you and I are always honest about that. Whenever we do interviews or podcasts, we are always very transparent in good. It's impossible. Like, to your point, Rabbi Leader, you can be good, right? Yeah. Like, but to be great, no.
And you know what? I'll tell you, I had a neurosurgeon call me after that sermon and said, but Steve, you don't want to go to a good neurosurgeon. You want to go to a great neurosurgeon when you're the one with the brain tumor. And I said, I won't use his name, but I said, that's true, But do you have to do every surgery? Do they all require your level of skill? Do you have to have an office in Sherman Oaks and Beverly Hills? Mm-hmm. Could you just have one office and maybe go home once in a while? Mm-hmm. Now, this is something I have struggled very, very much with in my life because, and you know this from the book, I was raised in a very harsh environment as a child, almost militaristic. And the only thing that my father valued was hard physical labor. Anything else was a complete and laughable waste of time in his cosmology. Mm-hmm. So this is something I've had to work very, very hard on. And the pandemic has made it easier. The question is, when the pandemic is over, how many of us will very quickly return to our default settings and those frenetic lives, which was like living in a centrifuge and it just spins us all apart? Mm-hmm. That's the question. Are you going to be back on the 405 and the 10 in uncomfortable clothes and shoes again, swearing in traffic, trying to get to a meeting with three or four people that you could just as easily Zoom with, by the way?
Mm-hmm. Well, now we know how easy it is to really just have meetings on our computer.
Yeah.
The lesson here is I want a neurosurgeon that's a bad husband.
I definitely
want a neurosurgeon who's a bad husband.
So I would love to start here because we are talking about ButcherBox, and I am the biggest ButcherBox fan. You have absolutely no idea. When I heard about it, I was like, oh, okay, I've heard about these subscription meats, yada, yada. The meat, Aaron, it is next level. Well, the chicken.
If I could just interrupt you for a second, what I heard happened is not that you cooked the ButcherBox meat and it was amazing, is that our mother cooked the ButcherBox meat at your house for you and your children, and now you're trying to claim like you cooked it.
Okay. I leave it to you to make me look like an idiot. I'm totally fine with that. Yes.
No idiots here, just looking for the truth.
Okay, so this is true. Mom was like, oh, I want to use ButcherBox. I've heard this meat's incredible. I said, yes, you get that grass-fed beef out. You get that free-range chicken. And she did.
Yeah.
It was so delicious that I am now cooking it. So yes, she did.
What were you doing while she was cooking the meat?
You know, I was probably showering at that hour.
What a life. So ButcherBox is really great to hire someone to make you dinner while you're in the shower or have your mother do it for free.
I love it. ButcherBox, it comes to the door. It's all frozen. It looks beautiful. Like you can just tell this is good quality stuff.
Also, I was truly shocked by how much meat was in my box. That's crazy. Very sexual, but I'm just saying I was truly shocked by how much meat showed up in that box.
Every month, ButcherBox ships a curated selection of the most high quality meats right to your house. All the meat is free of antibiotics and added hormones. Each box has 9 to 11 pounds of meat, which is what you were just saying, basically enough for 24 individual meals. You can customize the box. So they have the kind of options like 100% grass-fed and finished beef, free-range organic chicken, heritage pork, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, and sugar nitrate-free bacon. It's like your one-stop shop for any meat you could possibly need.
So just go to butcherbox.com/foster. That's a package of free bacon in every box for life when you get the subscription. And you need to go butcherbox.com/foster. That's butcherbox.com/foster. Okay.
You've heard us talk about Somersault. If you are a loyal listener, because we're obsessed with it for so many different reasons.
The only person who benefits if you buy Somersault is Sarah Foster, because she's an investor in Somersault. Guess who's not an investor? Aaron Foster, because I wasn't asked, but I am a model for them. So, you know, yeah. I'm associated, but Sarah will truly like cash out one day. If you
listen, I knew how good the product was. So I put my money where my mouth is, you know, the saying.
I do know that saying.
So Somersault, their data-backed designs, first of all, they are based off 1.5 million body measurements taken from 10,000 women.
Listen, I don't even need to give the stats, Sarah. Somersault is just a great company. Their bathing suits are very, very cute and somehow like make your body like look better than it did before you put the bathing suit on. Like it just shapes you and it like holds you in.
It's designer quality without the designer price tag. But guess what else? People are obsessed right now with the activewear. I did my own electric blue activewear.
Oh, here we go. This is Sarah Foster show.
The cover-ups, so chic.
All the cover-ups are the best.
I know. All right, get
to class. I don't want Sarah to succeed, obviously, or make any money out of this. I don't want her to have a successful business under her belt. That being said, I'll allow it for Somersault. So head to somersault.com. I think you know how to spell those two words, but I'm going to spell it for you. That is SUMMERSALT, summer as in the season, salt as in the spice. Hit it up.
Some people, by the way, are really happy working all the time, and that's okay.
Yeah, because we don't want to hear what we're saying, and you can, you know, I'll let you answer this. We're not saying to the woman or the man, you don't try to have it all. Like, you should be passionate about being a parent and a husband or wife and your job, right? Like, we have to work to provide. Like, what do we say? We're not discouraging somebody from trying to excel at all those things. We're just being realistic, right?
And I think asking them to be realistic with themselves.
Yeah.
Because there's a tremendous amount of internal bitterness that can be created.
That's for sure.
When you live in a vice grip all the time, It ends up destroying you.
Like, there's got to be a day, don't you think it ebbs and flows? There's got to be a day where, like, you have to choose between a commitment for your kid or a commitment for a family who's, you know, has a sibling that just died. And there are times you have to make the decision where you say, I'm so sorry to your kid, your wife, something. I can't be there because I have to do this thing first. Sometimes it's like, on this day, you are a better rabbi than a husband. The next day, you're a better husband than a rabbi. Like, doesn't it? I don't know. There are times that Simon comes home from work and he's so tapped out and so exhausted. He immediately puts on a basketball game. And I'm like, hello, you've been gone all day. You went to a work dinner. Now you're home. Now you want to watch basketball. Like, talk to me, engage. And he's like, no, I need me time. And And there's that, like, that sticky point where you just have to, like, care enough about what the other person needs and let go of what you need that day.
This is what I was referring to about the way that can become internalized as bitterness when you feel that you're constantly sacrificing for others.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond, outside of your own family, and you know, constantly is hyperbolic, but it's an exaggeration. But there have been long stretches where, you know, I'll tell you something quite shocking. And I'm not proud of what I'm about to tell you, but I'm just using it as an example to let you know that I've actually lived this reality that we're talking about. Last week, our son and his girlfriend were over for dinner. And they were, you know, talking about children and work and all of that. And Betsy, my wife, said, I was a single mother.
Mm.
And she didn't say it to be mean. She didn't say it with bitterness. She said it sort of for them to understand what can happen and how hard it can really be. But I have to say, it really, really caught me short. It really shocked me. And I do not disagree with her. I had just never heard her put it that way. I was a single parent.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm in no position to disagree with her.
Mm-hmm.
And the congregation was the other woman.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I have to live with that. I was younger. I was more ambitious. I'm not proud of it, but it can happen to any of us. Mm-hmm. You know, the irony of it is, of course, the Jewish counterweight to workaholism is Shabbat, is the Sabbath.
Mm-hmm.
But who's the one schmuck who's working on Shabbat?
The day you're supposed to put your phone down, you don't work. Right. It's actually against Jewish law. You're not allowed to work on Shabbat. Oh,
yes. So and who's crazy. The guy working?
Oh my God. You're supposed to be the holiest and you're going against the rule.
Yeah. I teach at 8:30. Then I do the service at 10. Then sometimes I have a service at 1:30. Then sometimes I have a service at 4:30. Then I have a wedding. It's one of my busiest days. It's so ironic.
That's not an easy life to have.
But then on the flip side, you've been married for a long time. You have children who you have very healthy relationships with. Like, you really,
yes.
she might have been a single parent because I deal with my own sort of version of that. And I said something similar to the father of my children recently, which we can get into that. It was also very shocking for him. He is a professional athlete and he looked at it like, well, who's I'm providing? You think I enjoy being, you know, leaving when our baby's 3 weeks old? I had to. That's another conversation. But but look at the life you've created for yourself, right? With these filled with what seems like very healthy relationships that parents that were maybe home more do not have.
I think it's a combination of the daily love and care that Betsy supplied. Mm-hmm. And my ability, I think I have this ability at work too. I often think of myself like an acupuncturist needle. How does an acupuncturist decide where to stick the needle? He or she decides to put the needle in the place where it will have the greatest systemic effect, mm-hmm. right? So I try to be very mindful and deliberate about my parenting and the time I spent with the kids and what we did during that time. I tried to be very, very strategic so that the things we did had a profound systemic effect, an echo effect in the family and in their lives. Mm-hmm. So we took vacations very seriously in our family, mm-hmm. right? We were home every Friday night for dinner, full stop.
So wait, what okay. do you do when you're doing Shabbat service?
Shabbat services were at 6. They ended at 7. I was home by 7:30 and we had Shabbat dinner. Wow. We didn't go to friends' houses. We never went out to a restaurant. I don't think I've ever been in a restaurant on Friday night for dinner other than on a vacation. Hmm. And so we found these strategic landing places that had an echo effect. And though, by the way, that's what the kids still talk about.
By the way, kids feel tradition. If something yes. happens, even if it's silly, we started during the pandemic having like unintentionally family Sundays at Simon and I's house. And it was just like my family, some of his family, any friends that wanted to come. And they knew every Sunday we're going to barbecue, we're going to have food, we're going to cook, we're going to make pizzas, we're going to do something, there's going to be kids. And this idea that anything happens on a specific day and it's repetitive and consistent, I think yeah. it makes kids feel really secure.
Kids crave structure. They crave yeah. it,
but
right?
But it's not even just structure. It's a consistent tradition. That's what Judaism is so good at, is creating those traditions.
I'll tell you, the way Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel put it is Judaism is the architecture of time. Mm. That our great cathedrals are moments, not places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the most holy thing. Yeah.
I'll give you a good example. The first time the word holy is used in the Bible is in the story of creation. Now, God, and we all know that's a creation myth. It's a way of explaining that the world was created as a single organic whole. It in no way was intended to say the world was created in 6 days, mm-hmm. okay? That's just reading it like a five-year-old. It was intended to teach us that there is a single unifying force to all of existence, and that the world was created not out of conflict, but out of whole cloth, right? Mm-hmm. In an organic way. All these things are created and called good. Day and night, good. Earth and sky, good. Human beings, very good, right? It's all good. The first time in the Bible the word holy is used, sacred, is in relation to a time, a day, the seventh day. God created the Sabbath and called it holy. Everything material and physical is good. Time is sacred. Now, this is also, I talk about this in The Beauty of What Remains in the book, because that's the thing that death teaches us is how precious time is. And that there are no rollover minutes in life. Mm-hmm. There are none. That's a cell phone. That's not your life. You don't get it back. And you know, I think specifically, that interview between David Letterman and Warren Zevon in the book, you know, when Zevon and Letterman both know that Zevon is dying within months, they know it. And Zevon is very clear about the sacredness of time. And I think that this is an important Jewish insight. Our great cathedrals are moments, They're not cathedrals. That's also, by the way, why Judaism is indestructible. Mm. You can't destroy Shabbat because it's non-material.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right? The Nazis powerful. Couldn't burn Yom Kippur. They couldn't burn Shabbat because they're non-material.
It's true.
How much do you feel like the way that you have parented in what seems to be like a very loving and, you know, hands-on, meaningful way is a result of your militarized childhood? Do you see that?
Yes.
You know,
like a correction on the other side.
Yeah. Like, do you see that from a lot of people you talk to that it's like just a polar, like explain to us.
Yes.
Sort of how, because a lot of people I'm sure have shitty childhoods. Not that yours was shitty. It was just different.
Parts of it were shitty.
Yeah. Yeah.
Look, I think we all learn from our parents what not to do.
Yeah.
As much or more than we learn what to do. Now, to get, again, maybe overly philosophical about this with you, I can give you a really good metaphor for how I think about this. I think about much of parenting, frankly, much of life, like I'm a sculptor. If you imagine for a moment, think for a moment in your mind about the most beautiful marble sculpture you've ever seen. Now, that marble sculpture began as a solid block of marble. That beauty was always there within it. But in order for the beauty of that sculpture to be revealed, what did the sculptor have to do? Take away, remove, not add. But remove. In Latin, this is called via negationis, creation by way of the negative. You create something by ceasing to create. You create something by removing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so parenting is this art of what you choose to remove, what dysfunction you cease to transmit to the next generation. Now, fully recognizing you're transmitting a different set of dysfunction to your children, that they're going to have to edit with their own children. Mm-hmm. The best we can hope to do is remove some of those chips and bits of marble to start to reveal something more beautiful generation after generation after generation. My parents did a better job with us than my grandparents did with them.
Mm-hmm.
We hopefully have done a better job with our children than our parents did with us. They will hopefully do a better job for theirs than Betsy and I did for them. And I think this is realistically the best we can hope for.
That's so simplistic, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Like the way that you put it, like it's just, it feels attainable. Like the way he says it to just, because my brain automatically goes to, you know, just remove. Just there's just certain, like,
kids just want to spend time with you. You know, kids want you to focus on them and kids want to spend time with you. And I think that being an adult is such a gift to your relationship with your parents because you get to look at things differently. And when we were kids, you know, anything that didn't revolve around us felt like abuse. Like, what do you mean you can't be at my play? What do you mean you can't be at my soccer game? What do you can't be? I'm the center of the universe.
When you're like, a kid, your parent isn't human.
Yeah, you just think that they can be everywhere and everywhere. And you don't understand a job. You don't understand the commitments. You don't understand having to be somewhere else. You just go like, you know, give it up and be there for us. And as an adult now, I think that we have a lot more compassion for how much more complicated it is than that. And I think when kids feel like you're seeing them, you're asking them questions, you're paying attention, and that I think that if a parent is really busy, but then when they come home, they put their phone away, they get on the floor, they play, they talk.
That was me.
They're present. You have consistent dinner. Everyone has to sit at the table. That stuff just kind of emits the feeling of a family.
I think that, first of all, I can tell you a few things that I think were most important. First of all, you have two choices when it comes to your children. You can love them or you can love them. Right? That's number one. Mm-hmm. All right. I don't care how angry you are. I don't care what stupid thing they do. I don't care. You have only two choices. You love them or you love them. The second thing I would say is how important it is to honor your child's blueprint. Not the blueprint you wish they were born with, but the blueprint that is uniquely theirs and not your blueprint. Okay. I remember sitting in a psychologist's office. Our son has and always had learning disabilities, and he ended up going to a remarkable special school. But it was a real challenge for me to understand him. How could he not be like me? And I remember this psychologist who has since died, who was a beautiful man. His name was Avi. And he looked at me square in the eye and he said, "Steve, this is your kid. This is who he is. Honor him." And it changed my relationship with him. It changed my life. It changed his world. So I had to learn that the hard way. Love them and honor their blueprint. Honor who they are.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's so hard though. I mean, I really fuck up as a parent all day long. I swear to God, how do I have two children? Like sometimes I'm like, I'm not even cut out for this. No, I'm like,
what? Betsy and I, let me tell you, Sarah, like, Betsy and I still, we've been married 35 years. We've had kids for 32 years. We still look at each other and go, can you believe we're the parents?
This is crazy. I called my girlfriend from like the bathroom floor the other day crying, going, I'm not cut out for this. This is crazy. Why did God impregnate me? I mean, why did the universe? Did the universe allow?
Oh my God, you were impregnated by God?
No, this is the virgin. Out so well the first time, I just want you to know.
The Virgin Mary is sitting right here in this podcast.
No, but literally, I was like, I love my children. I'll put a bullet.
But Sarah is not naturally maternal.
I don't like kids. Like, I love my children, but give me a baby. I don't want to hold your baby. Keep your baby to yourself. I want to hold my children.
I'm telling you, honor their blueprint.
I said to her the other day, I was like, you know, I was very scholastic. I did my homework. No one had to ask me to do it. I was organized. My shoes were all in a row. I did extra credit. I did everything on time. And my 10-year-old is the opposite. And I find myself saying things to her like, God damn it. You know, what is wrong with you? You haven't done your homework. When I was your age, and I'm like, I'm fucking her up.
Maybe she's lucky that she doesn't have OCD and her mommy did.
Right. Good. By the way, damn.
OCD.
Damn. No, for real. But like to look at it like that is so.
It's another way to reframe it.
So, yes.
That how lucky this little girl is that she doesn't have to suffer with the OCD that I had to suffer with as a child.
I mean, listen, shit. You say it like that and it's such a beautiful way of looking at it. And if I were to actually go a layer below, when I was her age, I was fucking sad. I was sad. I was all the things that she, I think, is sad sometimes, but I think her overall foundation is happy. You know?
Yeah, you had to torture yourself.
Yes.
So, or distract yourself. Really, or distract myself. Yeah.
Really, the things that are irritating you are really her greatest blessings.
This is not for show, but I just want to point out that I am sitting under my Jenny Kane blanket right now. Okay. I'm not trying to kiss up or anything. It just happens to be what I'm doing.
Wait, how did you get that blanket?
Oh, I got a blanket because I have a podcast called World's First Podcast. And one of our sponsors is Jenny Kane.
Jeez, that's a gorgeous blanket.
I know, very cozy.
Okay, so Jenny Kane, she's the chicest person alive. I don't know what else to say about her. She's just chicest.
Jenny Kane went to high school together. Sarah had many opportunities to endear herself to Jenny. If only you had befriended her a little earlier.
What I'm angling for is a Jenny Kane sofa. That's sort of my mission.
Okay.
That's sort of the goal here is
we're here for you to get a sofa.
But I also, what I love about Jenny Kane is all of her pieces sort of like elevate a room. It doesn't matter. Is it like a little bowl? Is it a throw? Is it a little candle? Like it just makes a room feel better.
If it has Jenny Kane's name on it, you need to have it.
From the wood tables to linen and boucle.
So really, it's anything you need. They have furniture now, which is new. They have pillows and throws. They have the Pacific Dinnerware collection. They have candles. They have slippers. Oh, I wear her slides all the time.
The Pacific Dinnerware collection starts at $25. That means that with our discount, you can truly start your collection.
Find your forever pieces at jennykane.com. Now, I'm going to spell that out for you because she spells her name in a really cute, chic way. That is JennyKayne.com. And you're going to get 15% off. Yeah, you heard right. 15% off your first order when you use the code FOSTER at checkout. That's 15% off your first order, JennyKayne.com, promo code FOSTER.
I'm excited to talk about Ritual. I'll tell you why, because I swear to God, I really noticed a difference. It's a protein powder that it just like holds your shit together. It's so important. It's every day. It's like a vanilla flavor. It is delicious. They've devised this protein powder that is just perfection. I can't say enough good things about it. What else? I mean, Ritual, it's a multivitamin company. You know, everyone knows about it. We all trust it.
Listen, I really love this company because it's all clean, plant-based formulas. And they're specifically created to support nutrient needs of different life stages. That's 18 and over, pregnancy and postpartum, and 50 and over like you. Mm-mm. I love that it's pea protein. You know, there's a lot of weird kind of proteins out there. And sometimes you're like, oh, this tastes delicious. Oh, I'm eating caterpillar. And this time you are just eating pea protein, which I really like.
As you get older, you lose muscle mass. And, you know, think about it. Like you lose muscle mass, no bueno. That is not a good look. There's no added sugar or, you know, the essential protein. It's soy-free. It's gluten-free. It's formulated with non-GMO ingredients.
Love that.
Guys, always check. Make sure you don't want no GMOs in your body.
So why not shake up your Ritual to try something new and less scary? Ritual offers a money-back guarantee if you're not 100% in love. Plus, our listeners get 10% off during your first 3 months. Just visit ritual.com/foster to add essential protein today. That is ritual.com, ritual.com/foster.
You know, I'll tell you something. I gave a sermon many years ago called Do What God Made You Good At. Mm. And it was for parents.
I like that.
You know, when you ask people, what did God make you good at? They always know. Kids always know. It's not always school, you know, or related to a job. But, well, let's find out. Okay, Aaron, what did God make you good at?
I guess being a writer or being funny.
Mm-hmm.
Sarah, what did God make you good at?
Mm. God made me good at, oh, God. What did God make me good at?
Don't feel nervous. Just say
it. No, I am. I just froze. You guys, did God make me good at nothing? I can't think.
So it was like, God sculpted my face and gave me nothing else.
God gave me two children. What God, well, I guess God made me creative.
Strong.
Yeah.
I also think, and
I was going to keep going, but.
We don't know each other well, but I also think God made you candid in a way most people are not.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a gift. Yeah. So you,
thank you, Rabbi Leader.
I think that so much of what I can tell you that when I talk with people, there's a piece about this in the book, at the end of their lives, most people don't regret what they did. They regret what they didn't do.
Right.
Because they didn't lean in to the thing or things God made them good at. Mm. And so I think so much of life is about leaning into what God made you good at. Whether or not society values that, whether or not that makes you rich, whether or not, you know, it's fashionable, it doesn't matter, right? You just lean into what God made you good at. And every kid knows what God made him or her good at. They do. But what does society do? What does school do? You have no idea how many times I have to say to parents who come to me, they know I had a kid with learning disabilities who went to the special school. So I get a lot of traffic coming through my office with parents who, you know, have that. Okay. And I sit these parents down and I say, let me tell you something. school is the only time in your whole life that you're expected to be good at everything. That's not how real life works. No one has ever said to me, Steve, you're such a great writer and speaker, and you're so compassionate, and you have such an amazing work ethic, but your Mandarin Chinese is very weak. Do we need to get you a tutor? Are you not applying yourself? How do you think you're going to be successful if you don't get a better grade in Mandarin? That's not life. That's not how life works. Most successful people lean into what God made them good at, and then they have other ways of compensating. They have other people in their life and other ways to accomplish the other things that are necessary.
Right. Like, how unrealistic is it to be good at math, PE, and Mandarin?
If I mean, about PE,
what do? We pound on our children. We pound on them.
That's so true.
And it sucks the life out of them.
I agree.
I give the graduation speech. We have two elementary schools, and every year I give the graduation speech to the kids in front of their parents, of course. And every year I say to the kids, I want to introduce you to a concept that your parents know but haven't shared with you yet. And that concept is there's going to be a time in your academic career where you're going to encounter a subject that you are just not going to be able to master. So I want to share two words with you that your parents and society have not shared with you yet. Those two words are just pass.
Just get by.
Wait, can my kid go to your school if I am not a Jewish person? Because this school sounds fantastic. Should I convert quickly? Because this could be good for us. What are the rules?
It is a school for Jewish kids, at least one Jewish parent.
Okay. Well, we could just list me as the mother.
Well, you're like the mother.
I'm basically her mom. So if Rabbi Leader just looks the other way, then we'll just register Josie as my kid.
I don't think it's good for kids to be in that environment where it's assumed they're Jewish when they're not. I think it's teaching them to not be comfortable with who they are.
True.
So we can talk about that offline. All I'm saying is that we tend to put children and therefore ourselves in these vice grip, highly unrealistic situations, and it creates a lot of internal bitterness and disappointment. And I'll tell you something, it's not a good way to live, and we don't have forever.
Mm-hmm. And you know what? Kids know how to, I mean, listen, every kid's different, so you can't, paint it with one brush, but we grew up with a dad who was very creative, who was obviously very musical, who was born with a very specific skill set.
And
a very high achiever. And we grew up around him constantly making music. And as we got older, people would always say, David, why didn't you have your daughters play piano and be singers and be musical? And he'd say, I don't have to do that. They know where the studio is. And if they're musical or if they're creative then they know exactly where to go. If I had grown up with access to a music studio at that age, like I would have done everything in my power to be there 24 hours a day. So if they love it, then they'll live and breathe it. And I don't have to tell them to be musical.
That's all I'm saying is support that proclivity or let your children do what God made them good at, whatever it is. And they're going to be fine. They're going to be fine.
Yeah, I agree. I think, I don't know what it is about parents that always want to make their children like them, but I think that it probably comes from a good place where it takes so long to get to a point in your adulthood where you feel good about yourself and you feel good about what you're doing. And you're so anxious to apply all those tools that worked for you to the person you love the most in the world. And sometimes they just don't need the same tools as you.
Yeah, and I think it comes from just inexperience. We're young. Most people are young when they have children and we're inexperienced and we make mistakes. But look, if we remove a few more chips to get to what's really beautiful than the generation before us, I can live with that.
But as a parent, where I go, if I'm just being really honest, I go to like, oh God, you're going to fail in life and you're not going to be self-sufficient and you'll be.
Remember what I said, Sarah.
I know.
School is the only time in a person's life when she is expected to be good at everything.
Yeah. But yeah. Don't you think we just get nervous because we just want so badly? It's not like I'm desperate for my child to be the next Elon Musk. I just don't want her to be.
I don't think nervous. Well, yes, you get nervous. But what I'm saying is, if you have the proper perspective, the nerves calm down quite a bit. If you have a gift and you have a family that appreciates and honors that gift,
you'll be okay.
You're going to be fine.
So true. I want to wait.
Oh, I have a question.
I was just going to ask about the cosmic.
I know. Can I? Okay.
Right. Sarah's
okay.
Just having a one-on-one, basically.
No, I have 1,000. Well, because you guys know each other. I'm just meeting him. So you
go ahead.
I feel like so many people go to Rabbi Leader almost as, I feel like you're like a therapist on steroids, right? Because people think of you as like a prophet in your world, right? So people go to you for marriage advice, for advice. You marry people, you give people. Yes. What is like the number one area that you are called to help and give advice?
A common denominator.
Yeah. Yeah.
Loss.
Ugh.
Now,
grief.
That can be the loss of life.
Yeah.
That can be the loss of your breasts. That can be the loss of your marriage.
Of a job.
That can be the loss of your public reputation.
Mm.
It can be the loss of a dream. Loss comes in many forms.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say that the common denominator
is loss.
And by the way, that's why I called the book The Beauty of What Remains, because when you suffer loss, it reveals, ideally, the beauty of what remains. And that's where we need to focus our lives. And it's not just that loss is painful, but I think what's most painful about loss are two things. First, it forces us to recognize that we are not in charge. That our lives are subject to forces beyond us.
And that's a
very difficult thing, especially for overachievers, to reckon with. And the second thing, I would say, that's at a very deep subterranean level when you're talking about loss, is that it really forces you. It forces you to reach out, because the most painful thing about loss, my previous book to this one was a book about pain. What do we learn from physical and emotional pain? It's called More Beautiful Than Before. And the worst part of pain is the feeling of abandonment and isolation. That's what hurts, that I'm in this alone and no one understands. And so therefore, ideally, what pain and loss teach us to do is to reach out. The Talmud says something so profound. The Talmud says, the prisoner cannot free himself. The prisoner cannot free himself. We have to reach out when we're suffering.
Hmm.
And the beautiful thing is that other people will reach back and help lift you from your suffering. Now, some people will not. One of the things I say to people who are going through a terrible, painful situation is you're about to find out who your friends are and who they are not.
Mm-hmm. The good friends force their way in even when you don't ask for help.
Yeah. And people you thought were your friends are going to, you know, disappoint you. And so the way I put that, it's a little cute, but it's easy to remember, is I say to people, look, when you're suffering and you reach out, the people who matter, they don't mind. And the people who mind, they don't matter.
It's so true.
It's so true. But we're endeared. I at least know that myself, like, I'm endeared to someone who's suffering far more than endeared to the person who's killing it and letting us all know how well they're doing. Like, if somebody wrote me and said, I'm in pain, I need a job, I can't pay my bills, whatever it is, I am at my low, I will do everything in my power I'll find that person a job. All right, I'll ask for favors. Like, it's so much easier for me to ask for a favor for someone else,
you know,
than it is for myself.
It's interesting you say that. people have asked me, how do you handle so many other people's suffering? How do you do 3 or 4 funerals a week and carry all that sadness and dead children and suicide and all of that? How do you do it? And I tell people, this is the truth. As far back as I can remember, the earliest memory I have of this is in fourth grade. I remember in fourth grade, Miss Hollingsworth class in St. Louis Park, Minnesota at Aquila Elementary School. There were about 25 kids in the class. I was probably 9 years old. And there was a girl in the class. I'm not going to use her real name because she's a real person and she could hear this. I'm going to call her Sally. Mm-hmm. And she was clearly different than the other kids. She had issues. Now, today we have language for that. We would say she was on the spectrum. Mm-hmm. She was autistic, but we didn't have those words in 1969. She was just a weirdo. Mm-hmm. She didn't read social cues, you know. And I fantasized in fourth grade. I didn't do it, but I fantasized about going to Miss Hollingsworth and saying, would it be okay if I just spent a few minutes with Sally and talked to her? Because I think I could help her. Hmm. So I have always, like you, Sarah, and I think I know you well enough to know, Aaron, that you too reach out to people who are suffering. Mm-hmm. I've always been the kind of person who runs toward a fire. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why.
Right. But, you know, I'm more inclined, and this definitely should be analyzed, like I'm more inclined to help. I have less of a, I don't know how to.
Well, we have to be able to be there for our friends when they're up to. You can't just be an ambulance friend, right? Like there are people who, are good friends
when
someone's suffering, but they're not great when that person's thriving and they're not great when that person's killing it. And like, I need both. I need friends who are there for me when I go through a breakup and also there for me when I'm happily married and like are happy for me. And sometimes like I've had a hard time figuring that balance.
I'm dealing with it not. And I think the difference is that my relationships generally are not friendships we're talking about. These are are people, you know, these are people for whom I'm their rabbi and they're seeking me out. Right. So I agree with you in terms of friends. Yes. But it's more professional, although some of the congregants are my friends. Mm-hmm. They're still congregants.
Of course. Right?
So there is that. But I think this question, you know, of what's the common denominator to the things most people come to me for, I think it is about loss. And I think it is about this cognitive dissonance, this tension of, I have control over my life. I have no control over my life. I have control over my life. I have no control over my life.
How much do you think ego plays a role in all those things? Like I know, for instance, like I was fired from something once. It was like 20 years ago. And I can still go back to the feeling I felt 20 years ago. It was like the chemicals in my body shifted. My DNA altered. Yes. I've experienced loss way worse. But that chemical reaction from being fired was so real and so physically painful. And I guess if I now, 20 years later, I was like, my ego. I didn't want people to know I was fired.
Mm-hmm. Remember, I was talking about these deeper subterranean levels to loss?
Yeah.
The one that hurts the most and helps the most going forward is humility.
Yep.
Humility. Right?
It's an important one.
Look, this is the book of Job in the Bible. Job is this blameless man. The first sentence in the book of Job is Job was a blameless man. This guy did nothing wrong. And God and Satan are having a conversation and God's bragging about his faithful servant Job. And Satan says, well, yeah, he has a great life. Of course he's faithful to you. Make him suffer and watch what happens, right? So God takes the bet. Job loses his family. They all die. He loses his health. He loses his business. His life is destroyed. And 3 of his friends come to visit and they all say, look, you must have been bad and God is punishing you. And he says, no, on the contrary, I've been good. I insist on my innocence. I haven't been bad. And finally, he gets his day in court with God. He goes before God and says, like, what are you doing to me? I've been a faithful servant to you. And God's answer to Job is, and who are you? Do you make the sun rise horizon set? Do you keep the ocean in its shores? Are you big? I am. In other words, you are not the epicenter of existence. Have some humility. It isn't all about you. You're only human. And bad things happen to good people all the time. The question is not why bad things happen to good people, because we can't answer that question. Why is a cul-de-sac? And you just go around and around and around. The question is, what, given that this can happen in life? What, given that the people we love die? What, given that cells can go mad within us and metastasize, right? What, given that our mental health can be compromised? What, given that you can get hit by a bus, right? What, given that that can happen, am I going to do with my life? How am I going to live? How am I going to live a meaningful, beautiful life with that humility, with that understanding that I'm not in charge fully and it's not all about me? So there's this old story that Carl Jung used to tell, a great psychologist and psychiatrist. Carl Jung was a disciple of Freud's. And Carl Jung was asked by a student who said, he was really quoting a Hasidic story, that long ago people used to see the face of God all the time. Why don't we see the face of God anymore? And the answer in the story is because no one can stoop low enough anymore to see the face of God. So the upside of loss, that feeling you had 20 years ago, Sarah, that was really humility. And I will bet you, and I'm interested in your answer, that changed your life in many ways going forward for the better, despite how painful it was.
Oh, I mean, finding humility, I did find it a little bit later than 20.
She's still finding it,
no,
Rabbi Leader.
But when I found humility, my life did change.
Yeah.
Yes.
Completely.
That was the biggest shift for you, I think.
That was the biggest shift in my entire life. I grew up, everyone telling me, you are tall, you're beautiful, the world revolves around beautiful women. I grew up, it was like, you know, it was kind of like a fucked up way to grow up, right? Like things just were really easy for me.
Sarah came into the world just feeling like everyone owed her something, you know? She was just like, I'm in charge. I'm not going to wait in a line at Starbucks and I'm not going
to
ask
for a job. I
wasn't
trying to wait in lines at 12. I mean, it was, right. Please. Just came I also had good qualities as a child, but mostly bad.
You actually might be Jewish.
Well, my name is Sarah. I mean,
we're partially Jewish.
But when I finally found humility later in life, my life changed in all beautiful ways. My
yes,
friendships and, got and, deeper. I found a partner who had like the actual right qualities to look for in a partner.
Valued the right qualities in you.
I valued the right qualities. It all
got
better.
Yeah. Let me ask you something.
Yeah.
Was the humility born of pain?
For sure.
Right.
For sure.
And not I'm not trying to say here that what we gain from pain is worth it.
Right.
I am merely saying it is not worthless.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Dostoevsky said his greatest fear in life was that his life would not be worthy of his suffering. I think that's such a profound idea. Can you be worthy of your suffering? I wrote this book to be worthy of my father's 10 years of Alzheimer's and his death. Mm-hmm. I wrote it to be worthy of the suffering I have witnessed and the suffering I have endured. You have led a life as a result of that humility, worthy of that suffering. I know, Aaron, I know you well enough to know, and we've talked deeply enough to know, that you lead the life you lead and seek the life you seek to be worthy of the suffering you have endured.
For sure.
And that is beautiful.
Mm-hmm. And there's purpose to it.
Yeah.
I mean,
yes.
I feel purpose to it. I mean, my marriage is like the most important thing in my life right now. And I suffered for so long, desperate to figure that out and feeling so unlovable and so like it's never going to happen. And, you know, I know, and so many women talk to me about this specific thing. So many women feel so bad about themselves if they have not gotten married yet or they haven't found their perfect person, that like missing piece to your life. And if I hadn't had those years, too many years, many years, a lot of years, Sarah was around for a lot of those.
Tons of years.
A lot of years.
Decades.
But I really don't think I'd appreciate what I have today if I didn't have that. You know,
that's right.
I really just don't think that I would have the same appreciation, bringing it back to some of your book, about the little tiny things. My favorite things about being married are so little. They're such specific, tiny things that Simon
and probably would be perceived by others as boring.
For sure. Oh my God. And like Simon always hated that I used to say like, I love how normal you are. You're just like a regular person. He thought that that meant that I was calling him average. And I was like, no, you're not average. You're far above average. But I love to me, the most exotic concept was like a normal marriage, like a normal, happy marriage with two people who stay together forever and like each other. That is like unheard of
to me.
So I'm like, oh my God, if we like laugh after a fight or like we both get in bed and I'm like, oh shit, I left the light on. And he's like, I'll turn it off for you. And I'm like, what? You're gonna get out of bed and turn that light off for me?
That's crazy.
Like, I'll go, well, that's my love language is acts of service.
In the beauty of what remains, I discuss this Yiddish expression, a bissel is a plotz, which in English means a little is a lot.
A little is a lot.
And by the way, I think the pandemic has really helped in this regard. You know, I've been asked in all these, so many interviews about the book, about comparing, you know, the loss of death to the losses of the pandemic and how they're the same and how they're different. And I say, well, look, first of all, death and the pandemic both teach us that a little is a lot.
It's true.
And good is great.
Very, very true.
And if you think about it, you know, I spend a lot of time in cemeteries and I'm always struck, even after I've probably been in cemeteries 12, 13, 1400 times. Oof. Okay. And I am always struck by the headstones and the fact that we're all unique individuals. We all lead different lives. But when you walk through a cemetery, almost every headstone says exactly the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you have to distill a person's life down to 15 characters per line and 4 lines per headstone, you are engaged in a very productive and important act of essentialism. You have to strip away all the nonsense.
Right. You're a brother, you're a father, you're a wife, you're a friend.
That's it.
That's it.
Right? Not your GPA, not your kid's GPA,
not your net worth.
Not your net worth, not your zip code.
A link to the new house you bought.
None of it. None of it. It all comes down to the tiny handful of relationships that really matter. And do any of us really have more than a tiny handful of people who matter? Mm-hmm. No.
But you are making me realize that I kind of want to make mine a little creative. Maybe I'll write on mine like,
Aaron's going to be like,
you better miss
writer,
me.
Emmy winner.
No, mine's going to say like, you better miss me. You know,
Aaron,
like,
oh God. You know what? And I'm saying this because I love and care about you. You know what I hope yours says?
What?
Loving wife, mother, grandmother, and friend.
Yeah, that's true. I guess that's good.
That's what I hope for you.
And by the way, that's all she hopes for herself.
Yeah, of course. But maybe I could just add like a little joke at the bottom. You know?
No, there are some outliers.
I like a little joke. What? What's the outlier?
You know that little cemetery in Westwood?
Oh, the one where Marilyn Monroe is?
Yeah, where Marilyn Monroe's buried and where Joe DiMaggio had the rose sent everything. So it's pretty much the most expensive cemetery
in
Los Angeles.
It's like a plot's like $1 million. You can't get in.
Yeah, and so my favorite headstone is there. It's a long row of celebrities and Rodney Dangerfield's buried in that row.
Mm-hmm.
And his headstone says, "There goes the neighborhood."
And by the way, he 100% came up with that.
Of course.
Well, he did. Yeah. He did, because his whole shtick was being self-deprecating. So he was self-deprecating in death as he was in life.
So Sarah and I are both married to foreigners.
Yep.
Technically, my husband was born in America, but who knows the real story behind that?
Mm-hmm.
Sarah's married to someone who is definitely not born in America. Full German.
Well, we're not married. Our listeners know we're not married, so you don't have to keep up that facade.
All right. Sarah's boyfriend Born in Germany. My husband is,
but I'm now in a situation where him and the kids are speaking German and I'm understanding, you know, every word.
And Simon, who is Russian, has always says to me, I wish you spoke Russian, because him and his brother, when they're in like a restaurant or somewhere, they can talk about other people, you know, behind their backs, because they have a secret language. Because like, how many people in that room are going to be speaking Russian? It's so important to learn a new language. Like, why not? We have so many tools now. Speaking of a new tool, we are here to tell you about Babbel, which is number one selling language learning app. Okay.
Yeah. Why didn't I have this 15 years ago when I met this guy?
Yeah, for ordering in restaurants or asking directions or finding out if your husband's cheating on you. You got to learn their language. That was just personal for Sarah and I.
Yeah, that felt pointed.
No, I just want to know what he's talking about when I can't understand him.
Yeah. No, but it really is so cool. The amount of times I find myself in situations where I now ask my five-year-old, I'm like, what'd she just say? What did she just say? So I love, love, love this app. Babbel designs their courses with practical, real-world conversations in mind, things you're going to use in your everyday life. Like for Aaron, are you cheating on me?
Babbel's 15-minute lessons make it the perfect way to learn a new language. Because guess what? My brain can't do anything for longer than 15 minutes.
Mm-mm.
Definitely
not. No. Plus, this is what I love. Babbel's speech recognition technology helps you to improve your pronunciation and your accent. Because that's half the battle, right? You got to like say it right.
Yep. They have the best teaching method. It's just much more conversational. With Babbel, you can choose from 14 different languages, including Spanish, French, Italian, and German. Sarah, you really got to find out what your kids are talking about.
I know.
So right now, when you purchase a 3-month Babbel subscription, you're going to get an additional 3 months for free. That is 6 months for the price of 3 months. Just go to babbel.com. That is BABBEL.com and use the promo code FOSTER. Okay. B as in bonnet. A. B as in bonnet again. B as in bonnet again. E as in bonnet. L as in love.com.
Okay. I hate to admit this, but Erin did introduce me to Framebridge. It's annoying when she has resources and good ideas. It doesn't happen often, but I am a person that loves a framed photo. It just, every room in my house is a framed photo. The frame photos all the way up my stairs.
A lot of
just
photos makes me- of Sarah herself in a frame in her own house.
Yeah, a lot of frame, you know, solo shots.
Sarah loves the picture of herself.
I think it just makes a room feel so cozy, and I love up the stairs. It just looks so nice. Anyways, I'll land the plane here. I was the idiot that was doing it literally the way that I would frame my photos. I would take a picture, then I would go to CVS, and I would have to print out, and then I'd go to a frame store and I'd walk in and I would do it all myself, and it would take like the entire day. Okay. And Aaron was like, are you with us? Like, have you joined this century? Because have you ever heard of Framebridge? They do everything for
you. Our last like Christmas holiday, I decided my gift to everyone was framing photos. I framed photos to your daughters,
best gift,
them and their cousins, me and V at my wedding, just like cute photos of the whole family. And it was all Framebridge because it was so easy. I sat on my computer, and they have very good customer service.
And you don't have to leave your house. You sit in your freaking office, your living room, your kitchen, whatever it is, and you literally do nothing.
Instead of the hundreds of dollars that you're going to pay at a framing store, their prices start at $39, and all of their shipping is free, which is important because all of them need to be shipped. Plus, our listeners are going to get 15% off your first order at framebridge.com when they use the code FOSTER. So order online at framebridge.com or stop by a Framebridge store I didn't know they had a store to work with a designer in person. If you're in New York City, DC, Atlanta, or Philly, didn't know that.
I just want to say, not only for your own personal home, is this not amazing? Doing up the stairs, doing all those things, a framed photo just looks so nice, but it's the greatest gift ever.
So get started today. Frame your photos or send someone the perfect gift, like a photo of yourself, like Sarah would do. Go to framebridge.com and use the promo code FOSTER to save an additional 15% off your first order. Just go to framebridge.com, promo code FOSTER. That is framebridge.com, promo code FOSTER.
I have so many questions about relationships and you know, what your stance is on keeping families together who have children. And I know we can't probably get into all of that today because our followers have questions. And then we have a couple questions from the book that I know that the one I really want to know about is about how you say the whole notion that we have to make amends and be okay with people before they die is like not true. And that it's okay to not go out of your way to repair relationships before death. I'm so interested to hear your thought on that. And then I know Aaron has.
Well, in a way it relates to that Rodney Dangerfield story because the point I make in the book is that people die exactly the way they live. And individuals and families face death exactly the way they face life. Death does not give anyone a new personality. So, you know, people will come to me and say, Steve, I've had a horrible relationship with my father my entire life, but he's just been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. He's got 3 to 6 months. I'm flying back to New York to see him. And I'm really looking forward to reconciling with my dad and having a beautiful last chapter. And I say to that person, I hope you're right, but experience has taught me that people tend to face death the same way they face life. And that your dysfunctional relationship with your father in life is probably going to continue despite the fact that he's dying. Because dying doesn't give anyone a new personality. You know, there's a German poet named Heinrich Heine who made a joke about the Jews. He said, the Jews are like everyone else, just more so. Right? So
that's true.
This is true. This is true of death and the dying and the people who love them. It doesn't change a dynamic. It makes everything and everyone more so. Right? So if you were close and loving and communicative in life, you're going to be that way in death. If you were dysfunctional, bitter, sniping, angry in life, you're going to be that way in death. And I think, Sarah, the part of the book you're referring to most specifically and is most surprising to most people is people come to me and say, Steve, my relationship with my mother has been torturous my whole life. I have only been made to feel terrible when I'm with her. And I haven't spoken to her in 3 years. And it's been the best 3 years of my life. But now she's dying. And I'm worried that I'm going to feel guilty when she's dead. And I say to people in these extreme situations, this is not the usual, it's 15% of the time, I say to them, well, here's the little dark secret no one will share with you, but I will. You're not going to feel guilty. You're going to feel relieved.
Wow.
And that's the truth.
Right. That's the hard truth.
That's right.
That's just the real. And that's dark in some ways, but also
Liberating.
Yeah. Exactly.
So you have to deal with what is. You have to deal with what somebody's offering you. And I think.
Well, and this idea that death or dying changes things, that's a fantasy. It's not true. And sometimes it's beautiful that it's not true because if you have this great loving relationship in life, you're going to have that in death. And sometimes it's terrible that it's true because if you have this terribly dysfunctional relationship in life, you're going to have it in death. But it's always true, whether that truth is beautiful or ugly, it's still the truth.
Well, this is what I love about Judaism is that you live in the gray because Judaism and Jewish faith is all about family. And it's so important to stay together and it's so important to be close to each other. But like sometimes you have a toxic family member and in that situation, it's okay to remove yourself from that family or those people because it's not
That's
good
right.
for you.
I've been
That's
meaning
right.
to do that.
Oh, this is that moment?
After this conversation, I have decided.
Oh, wait, am I the toxic person that you were thinking of?
Very liberating, Rabbi Leader.
I guess this is the last podcast.
This is the last time.
This is it.
This is it. And I am liberated.
You will be relieved.
I will be relieved. This is the greatest day of my life. Thank you, Rabbi Leader.
You're welcome.
Okay, so we've gone way over. I'm sure you have somewhere to go. So there's just one specific question that we wanted to ask.
And then I have one after that.
Okay, so there's just one for me to
go. There's two more.
So
we'll do two more.
This one is about cosmic justice and earthly justice. If you could explain the difference.
Yes. Well, I'll give you an example from the book of Job. This is basically, we talked about the book of Job. God was basically saying to Job that cosmic justice and earthly justice are not the same thing. That human beings only see a tiny fragment of existence. And we don't understand how what happens fits into the much larger picture. By the way, this is what an Orthodox rabbi would say to you if something terrible happened in your life. The rabbi wouldn't necessarily say you sinned and are being punished. The rabbi would say, I know this hurts, Aaron. I know this hurts, Sarah. But you have to have faith that in ways you can never understand. This is all part of God's bigger plan for the cosmos. And that cosmic justice and earthly justice are not the same thing. Now, I don't find that a satisfying answer. I would never say that to the parents of a two-year-old who dies, you know, of cancer. Oh. But it is... the older I get, something I think quite a bit about, which is our knowledge is minuscule in relation to the cosmos. You know, when our daughter Hannah was a very little girl, she used to like to take the sugar container and she would drink sugar all day long if we let her. And obviously we didn't let her. She thought that we were evil and unjust. What she was experiencing is that cosmic justice and earthly justice are not the same thing. The parent has a much broader understanding than the child. And so what the child feels is unjust is actually quite in the child's in best interest.
So right? Is it another way of saying rejection is divine protection?
It sounds good. I'd have to think about it a little bit.
It's like the breakup that you wish didn't happen that you learned later needed to happen.
I would go this far. You know, I wrote this book, More Beautiful Than Before, How Suffering Transforms Us. I would go this far. And it was what I asked Sarah about when she learned humility and whether that changed her life for the better going forward. I will say that pain is the great teacher because it disrupts us. You know, Marsha McLuhan, the Canadian philosopher, said, I don't know who discovered the water, but it wasn't the fish. A fish doesn't even know it's in water because it's born in water, lives in water, and dies in water. So ironically, the fish of all creatures has no idea about its own life. When does a fish discover water?
When it's taken out?
Yeah, when you take it out. That's when a fish discovers water. That's when a fish gets perspective on its own life, when it's gasping for air. This is what pain, this is what loss does. It disrupts us. It yanks us out of our complacency, and it forces us to reevaluate our lives. And I'm willing to go that far.
Wow. What's your question, Sarah?
Well, that was...
It's the final question.
That was intense. So. Well, I actually think that my question really is a great sort of like tie-in to all the themes that we're talking about and sort of back to your book. Since we have... decided that your book essentially about death is the thing that is supposed to teach and inspire us how to live. I am curious. You're someone who visits a lot of people towards the end of their life.
Yes.
What are the most common regrets that people have? And I think your answer will inspire us on how to live.
Great. Great question.
Most people regret not what they did, but what they didn't do. The opportunities for joy and love and passion and fun that they did not grasp. You know, I think ultimately one of the most important things that loss, this pandemic, death comes to teach us is that no matter how many times we say, I love you, And no matter how many times we hold and are held by the people we love, it's never enough.
Mm-hmm.
Never enough.
Do you want a hug?
I want to, not you. Oh. I want to hug Rabbi Leader, not you. You crazy?
Okay.
Jesus. No, you were just going in for a hug, weren't you?
I'm quite serious about that. You know, it's, don't miss the opportunity to love and be loved.
I agree. No, it's true. It really is true. It's all a quality time.
Right. It's true. No one is like, God, I wish I just made that deal happen. Or I wish I bought that stock. Or I wish I...
More crap, you know?
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah. No, it's ultimately about what's going to be on that headstone.
Yeah.
And can you live in alignment with that?
Well, I could talk for like four more hours. So I guess we're going to have to do a follow-up.
Part two.
We'll do the sequel.
We need to do part two.
Amazing. It was so great. Thank you so much for doing this. And I
appreciate what you're doing, you know, to help bring this book into the light. It means a lot.
The Beauty of What Remains by Rabbi Steve Leader. But I'm also really intrigued by the other book, the titles you were mentioning. So we're going to have to read those
Sarah's
too.
Sarah's going to have to do a big deep dive and buy your other books.
And I'll see you at Temple.
I'll give you room on the bus, Sarah.
Okay. Thank you, Rabbi Leader.
Thank you, Rabbi Leader.
Bye. If you like this podcast, leave a rating and review.
This podcast is executive produced by...
Can you not use that voice?
I'm sorry, I'm trying to sound...
Yeah, but you don't need to make it sexy.
This podcast is executive produced by...
Do you have a normal voice?
Yeah. Aaron Foster, Sarah Foster, and Allison Bresnick.
Okay, I'll take over. Our associate producer is Montana McBurney. Our audio engineer is Josh Windisch. This show is hosted by Simplecast.
See, that didn't sound nice.
That sounded great.